Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The federal government's largest security organization has a new director. David Kettler has been at the helm of the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency for about 3 weeks. A veteran intelligence official, Kettler now oversees an agency that conducts 95% of the background investigations across the government. In his first interview since taking over at DCSA, Kettler spoke with Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday and detailed his thoughts on insider threats, personnel vetting, and the future of artificial intelligence at the agency.
I think the first thing is, I am really struck. So again, thanks for this, the opportunity to sit down and talk about not just what I'm doing, but really the agency. The Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, really only been around since 2019. But these predecessor organizations go back generations in both the Department of Defense and the Office of Personnel Management primarily. We've had some other pieces come together from some other organizations, but really the core. Defense Security Service and predecessor organizations got to be, what, a 50, 60-year legacy. The OPM side, I don't know the exact number of years, but I know it's decades there also. So one challenge is just, how do we really explain to people who we are and what we're doing here? It was a huge change in 2019 to come together, really sparked by some decisions that were actually taken in 2016 in both law passed by Congress and by executive order from the president to make some of these combinations. And I think in no small part driven by the fact that there had been some real problems with protection of some of the security files. We've had some large cyber incidents that led to some hacks in which a lot of those records were compromised. And at that time, 2015, 2016 timeframe, there were also some things that happened in the private sector with some websites that have similarly large user bases and things, credit rating agencies, for example, as well, that were hacked. And I think fair to say that one of the central thoughts was, let's combine these efforts into one agency. So I think one thing that's on my mind now strategically is the idea that we are really the nation's largest and I think the premier security services provider. Again, 15,000 staff, a budget that's in the billions of dollars range, 172 locations in 50 states. That's no small thing. And when you consider that when you add the numbers now to the missions, you're talking, 3.6, 3.7 million people that DCSA is responsible for doing initial security investigations on and then sustaining the reviews over time in this continuous vetting model, that is a tremendous responsibility. It's actually 95% of the cleared base in the U.S. If you want to have a government job that requires a security clearance or a job even at a defense contractor that requires a security clearance or elsewhere across the government, 95% likely a DCSA agent will come to visit you and will do that interview. And that's about establishing that first trust with you, to really be sure that the government can trust you to have access to our secrets. Then we need to be sure that we can continue to trust you. 12,000 plus facilities, again, no small thing for them to do all these related missions. So the first task, I think, is to really be sure that people know who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it and that we do it well and that we're responsible about the protection of that critical data. I mean, I know that I would not want all of the material that the government has collected on me to determine that I'm trustworthy to be made available to anybody that wishes to exploit it for one reason or another. So I think that's a really serious commitment that we've taken up. The second thing I'd say is that I think it's really important that we put a marker down that with 5 years of early agency formation between 19 and 24, that's over, that we're now at a point where we're pretty close to full performance, but we need to really be sure that we're there. And I think for me, that's a good strategic goal right in the beginning. And then finally, I'm beginning to challenge the team with the idea that we really need to give some thought to the far future. So if you take maybe the year 2040, the question I'm asking the leadership team and the workforce more broadly is, what is the nature of the work environment for us look like in 2040 if you take the core missions that I laid out to you? Because I think those largely will remain stable between now and then, the next 16 years. What do the threats look like between 2024 and 2040? What technology do we need? How do we change our operating model to adjust to that? Personnel security, industrial security, counterintelligence especially. We have a huge amount of data. Are we able to exploit that data? Are we using artificial intelligence properly? Are we using whatever comes after artificial intelligence properly? Are we anticipating that? to really take advantage of having access to that huge mountain of data in order to do things smarter, more efficiently and effectively, hopefully a greater economy over time with increased effectiveness, so that we can identify trends, we can make your clearance review time shorter, consistently shorter, while still having very high reliability as we do those checks. We can provide that trust basis, but a very high confidence in that trust basis. How do we cover all those facilities? What's the best way to do that? How can we be more efficient and effective there? What aspects of the threat capabilities do we need to anticipate and prepare for so that we maintain an edge against all those potential threats? Now, I think simply, you know, when you talk about threats, I think we have some that we have to be mindful of that are more inside. We have some that are outside. So we have to be focused on like the area I came from. Foreign intelligence collection is incredibly capable, and it spans all the collection domains. So if I look at personnel security and industrial security, what I'm concerned about are espionage related to recruitment of key people that we have in our system, either to get information from them directly or to get access through them to information or to facilities or to networks within facilities. And I think the nature of that type of threat is not going to change that much, because I think it is what it is. But the sophistication of it gets better and better. Just to give you one example, I mean, you go to remote work, you have so many people working remotely, you've got more and more cyber activity going on. You're using video teleconference from your house. You're sending more and more emails. You're using more and more remote storage for all the files. Okay, that's great, but that also presents an even larger target for hostile collection, whether it's government or criminal, to go after that data, to get into that facility, get into that network. And that's challenging, because in some cases you're not talking about a facility, like a corporately owned or a government-owned facility that you can actually take more firm control over. You're probably talking about a lot of people working from home or working on the move. They're in a Vrbo somewhere, and they're just set up, and they're on their phone, they're on a laptop. So it's just a lot more challenging. And I just kind of end very briefly by saying that, I mean, you think about that insider threat mission, sadly, it's also us that we have to take a look at. It's not just people on the outside. We also have to be really alert, sadly, to the fact that it could be the person in the cubicle next to you who's having a really bad day or has had a series of really bad days, credit problem, marital problem, just may need some help, you know, medically, psychologically, that could also cause, I mean, I'd say it's a problem as a euphemism. I mean, it could really create some violence in the workplace. And as I say, that's a charge we also take very seriously. So we have to think about all those things when we look across these mission areas.
And I want to key in the insider threat and how the trends there might be evolving. I don't know if you've had a chance to review what happened with the Discord leaks, for instance, but that was kind of a new kind of insider threat. I mean, are there any lessons learned that DCSA can take forward? And do you see that type of threat, the perhaps not someone who's motivated by payment to a foreign government or anything like that or blackmail, but just doing it for clout, as many people have pointed out? Are there any lessons there?
There's really not a lot I can say on that yet, because not only is the analysis still ongoing, but the prosecution is still proceeding. So I frankly can't get into it that deeply. But I think the way that you frame the question, I'd probably just respond more to the question directly and say that I think motivations for people to engage in unauthorized disclosures are going to vary. But the idea that someone would leak or that someone would unlawfully give information to someone generally shouldn't have it, maybe even the media, right in that, or to a foreign government, the idea that certainly is almost as old as time. People do a lot of things. I mean, you say clout, I think we would say it's more driven by ego, usually, money ideology as well in that. But again, we take a hard look at it. But I think for my agency, we are going back to take a look at some lessons related to, you know, how are we handling that as a personnel security matter? What does that tell us? Because again, we're doing not just the initial investigations for the great proportion of the cleared population, but we're also doing this continuous vetting model. So we need to be sure that applies properly, that we have the right information sources and so on. And then also, as you began in the question, it is an insider threat challenge also. What can you see? What can't you see? So lots to take a look at in there, but right now we can't go that far into it.
Gotcha. I mean, and not necessarily just focusing on that area specifically, but even before that incident, there had been some calls to take a closer look at things like social media and online activity. Do you have any early notions of how you want to approach that as DCSA director in terms of the vetting that you do of the cleared population?
Yeah, well, I think first, there would seem to be tremendous value in it, but it needs to be done properly. It needs to be done legally, and it needs to be done within well-established bounds so that you don't commit, obviously, that illegal violation, but also that you're respecting privacy properly. It's a proper balance that needs to be struck. It happens in intel all the time also, not just in security. And as I say, it's a responsibility that we take very seriously. That is a key component, in fact, of the oversight that intelligence and security services are provided. Mine no exception to that. So I'm eager to understand more. Again, I'm only on day 19. So I'm eager to understand more about what's the current state of the art, where we are in that, and what else is available. But I also want to be sure that I tell the audience here that I take the civil liberties requirements and the privacy requirements also incredibly seriously. There are some things that we should see. There are some things we shouldn't see. But I think the thing that I most want to understand, because I'm not a lawyer either, but when I talk to the lawyers, the thing I most want to understand is if someone posts publicly, if someone just puts out their views, arguably maybe more rational, easier than for you to have firm justification to go and get the data potentially, right? But let's really take a look at it and understand it.
I make sure that we reserve time to dive into your priorities on the personnel vetting front, talking specifically about things like security clearance, timeliness, continuous vetting. What are some of your initial impressions of how those initiatives are going, how the Trusted Workforce 2.0 initiative is being carried out here at DCSA and where that is going?
Well, first let's set the stage just with the scope. So as I said, so we're the government's largest investigative service provider. And we do conduct 95% of all background investigations for more than 100 federal agencies and for the Department of Defense. Now, that means that we're taking in about 10,000 background investigation requests every day. We finish about 2.6 million investigations annually. And that's a combination of initial and subsequent. So if you take, like in my case, I think I had an initial investigation in 1989, and I've had one every 5 years since. So that's where those numbers come from. We also conduct individual clearance adjudicative decisions. So in regular words, what that means is after the investigation's finished, all the information goes in, there's a person called an adjudicator who's going to look at that file and compare the results of the investigation, the elements of the file, to these guidelines to determine, are you eligible? Should you be trusted? And then we have the government then takes a further decision of what level of clearance, what level of information should you have. We also implement continuous vetting, as we've touched on, for DOD, the defense industry, and again, that 100 federal agencies, as part of Trusted Workforce 2.0. So this is a whole of government effort to reform and transform the personnel security process to establish a single vetting system for the government. Now, I've read a tremendous amount on Trusted Workforce 2.0, and I just got to participate in my first principals-level meeting across government about progress on this. And I got to tell you, this is a hugely impressive and important effort to really take a hard look, not just at how long does it take for you to get a security clearance, an initial or a successful reinvestigation, but also what can we do to better enable flexibility and mobility and reciprocity for security clearances across the government. What new technology can we use? How can we be more efficient? Have we taken a good hard look at the business processes? Have we looked at the correlation of those two? Really with the mind, and this is what I say, it's just what a brilliant initiative to really consider. Have we wrung all of the inefficiencies out of the system with proper balance between desired timeliness and rigor so that the trust basis is established and is accepted by everyone who needs to then make these decisions about, well, how much do I trust you? You know, what information can I give you? But also to think through some things like, you know, what if you want to leave government and come back? What about cases in which things that maybe were looked upon far more negatively in the past are now accepted, laws change, societal views on issues change, and that sort of thing? Are we modernized in the way that we look at those social factors and you as an individual? And what do we need to anticipate in the future? Really with the idea that security, again, is about trust and about risk management related to it, so you have to have the right balance, but also with our eyes wide open to the idea that, if you want to maintain a competitive industrial base, if you want to get the best and brightest into government, and especially today, where people do want to take sabbaticals and try different things and travel internationally and study in different places and go in and out of the private sector to the government, to think tanks, to frankly just take some time off. How can we do that smarter so that, again, we can attract and retain really talented people from across all elements of our society? And that's what this is about. So really keep your eye on Trusted Workforce 2.0, because I think this is just a brilliant thing. We're also working on the National Background Investigations Services platform. That's our IT backbone. Some work to do in that to complete that project. But, I mean, imagine at the core, this is really the case file management tool for all of those investigations. Again, that 2.6 million investigations annually and all of that data processing, storage, everything from the investigation then through to the adjudicators. We're going to take a look at those files, quality control in that as well. And that's a huge, huge lift. So a lot going on in personnel security, not just in ensuring that we're efficient and effective, but also, as I say, with Trusted Workforce 2.0 and really taking a whole of government look at how can we do this smartly. And I think great to have from the top down. This is the strategic vision for the future. These are the big strategic capabilities within the space that we want to be able to deliver. This is the effect. Let's do that together. You know, how can we get that done?
For DCSA, it does seem as if the INBIS system is now such a crucial part of how this moves forward. And I know that it's faced some scheduling issues, and the agency is taking a look at that, and it now has a new program manager who's just come in as well. I mean, is that something that you've been briefed on and that you are looking at any specific challenges there you want to address?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time on this coming into the job, and even in the brief time I've been in the job. So I'm the new director. We've hired a new program manager. We've also hired a new program executive officer. INBIS is one of several programs that DCSA has within it that are IT developmental related, and the PEO then assists all of those programs to mature, including INBIS. We're at a period now, especially since I'm new, but there was an ongoing effort already to take a look at where are we in terms of the expertise, what do we need, what do we have, training, all of that. Do we have the right people inside, outside? We're taking a hard look at the contractual framework. What are the requirements? What have we specified? Where are we? What's the timeline? What's the cost? And then finally, to make sure that we have the right people in the right places and the right structures for oversight. I'm not going to go too deep in that because I'm still doing my due diligence there. But just to say that this is really the core IT program within my agency. And that software is integral not just to DCSA's work, but also back to Trusted Workforce 2.0, because it's in no small part a major systems element of all of this about personnel security reform, about the way we investigate grant security clearances and maintain those files. So looking at it very, very closely and diligently, we're going to manage it with proper accountability and oversight.
And bringing it back to what you said earlier in terms of looking toward the future, 16 or more years from now to 2040, you spoke about the role that technology, AI, automation might play in the processes here. Do you have any more detail in terms of where you'd like that to go, in terms of how you want to look at how technology plays a role and what DCSA does on a day-in and day-out basis?
Yeah, we're still working on the concept, but I just maybe give an early indication of the way we're starting to think about it. We are a security services provider that engages in operations in those, at least the first three categories I listed, right? Personnel security, industrial security, CI, and insider threat. We have an IT development responsibility now, especially in the form of INBIS, but we're not the same as like DISA. We're not Google, right? We're not a big information technology firm, nor are we a big information technology government agency. But we do have this responsibility for INBIS, and as I said, you know, we're gonna get that program delivered because we need it, and the government needs it. But I do think that in addition to being a security services provider, we are a data-centric agency, because we do have that tremendous amount of information that we maintain in all these very unique relationships with certainly the defense industry, but also all across government. And one of the central questions I'm asking is, are we wringing all of the potential value out of that pool of data today? And what else can we do? What else should we do to take full advantage of all that data between now and, again, this notional year of 2040? I was an analyst when I first came to the intelligence community, and I tend to look at this through that lens, actually, as an intelligence analyst. And the thing I just wonder is, if you take warning of potential problems in background vetting and security adjudications as an indications of warning problem, elements of counterintelligence and insider threat as an indications of warning problem, I am certain that there are, even today, more tools that we could be using that are cutting edge in the private sector that may be fielded, may be developmental, that would have application to our work to more easily manage, curate the current data set we have, to take advantage of even new data sets that could give us different signatures, all with the mindset that what we want is the earliest possible identification of a potential issue for personnel security, industrial security, or a counterintelligence and cyber threat problem. So that ideally you can take an affirmative intervention early and prevent a problem from manifesting. Also to take a look at trends. And I think another thing I'm fascinated with is the idea of having, I don't want AI to replace the human in the process, because I think critically important, especially for these decisions that are incredibly subjective, that we have a human make the final decision. But I think it'd be great to have AI-enabled training aids for the adjudicators, for the investigators, for the agents involved in counterintelligence and insider threat work. And also for them, just to maybe even to point out, for example, you're saying this is maybe a no in a person's file. This is a potential flag you've got to take a look into. But did you know that 98% of your colleagues say that this isn't a red flag? And click here if you want more information about that. Click here if you want me to bring up the relevant instruction. Click here if you want me to bring up the guidelines. Click here if you wish to proceed, if you're okay with this decision. So I think things like that could actually give us better training, coaching, mentoring. We could use it for trend analysis and so on to even further refine that tool itself and also the quality of the skills of the humans that we have in the system. It's an incredibly huge amount of cases that we're looking at for individuals and facilities. And I don't think, in fairness to the people who work really hard to do the work, or frankly to the taxpayer, that the answer is going to be we just hire an infinite quantity of people and we spend an infinite quantity of money. I mean, that's just not reasonable. So there has to be a way that we can use better technology and better exploitation of the data in order to be efficient and effective in a way that doesn't require us to spend massive amounts of money to have infinitely growing staff levels and budgets. I'm not the smartest guy in a room on those things, so I'm not sitting here telling you, no, I know it's this and this and this. But what I am saying is that already in 19 days, I've come in contact with a great number of people inside government and outside government who are that smart, who do have those connections, who have equal passion for the work, who are saying, yeah, let's get together and talk about it. Because they're very excited about what that future could be, as is our team within DCSA.
David Cantler, director of the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, speaking with Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.